Chapter 11. The next morning, by yellow cab, since now not only was his cephscope laid up for repairs, but so was his car, he appeared at the door of Engelson Locksmith with $40 in cash and a good deal of worry inside his heart. The store had an old wooden quality, with a more modern sign but many little brass doodads in the windows of a lock type. Funky, ornate mailboxes, trippy doorknobs made to resemble human heads, great fake black iron keys. He entered into semi-gloom. Like a doper's place, he thought, appreciating the irony. At a counter where two huge key-grinding machines loomed up, plus thousands of key blanks dangling from racks, a plump, elderly lady greeting him.
"Yes, sir. Good morning."
Arctor said, "I'm here."
"Ihr Instrumente freilich, spottet man, mit Rad und Kamen, Walz und Bugel. Ich stand am Tor, ihr solltet Schlüssel sein. 2 Uhr Bad ist kraus, doch habt ihr nicht der Regel."
"To pay for a check of mine, which the bank returned. It's for $20, I believe."
"Oh."
The lady amiably lifted out a locked metal file, searched for the key to it, then discovered the file wasn't locked. She opened it and found the check right away, with a note attached.
Mr. Arctor?"
"Yes," he said, his money already out.
"Yes, $20.
Detaching the note from the check, she began laboriously writing on the note, indicating that he had shown up and purchased the check back.
"I'm sorry about this," he told her, "but by mistake, I wrote the check on a now-closed account rather than my active one."
"Hmm," the lady said, smiling as she wrote.
"Also," he said, "I'd appreciate it if you'd tell your husband who called me the other day." "My brother, Carl," the lady said, "actually."
She glanced over her shoulder.
"If Carl spoke to you,"
she gestured, smiling.
"He gets overwrought sometimes about checks. I apologize if he spoke, you know."
"Tell him," Arctor said, his speech memorized, "that when he called, I was distraught myself, and I apologize for that, too."
"Well, I believe he did say something about that, yes."
She laid out his check. He gave her $20. "Any extra charge?" Arctor said.
"No extra charge."
"I was distraught," he said, glancing briefly at the check and then putting it away in his pocket, "because a friend of mine had just passed on unexpectedly."
"Oh, dear," the lady said.
Arctor, lingering, said, "He choked to death alone in his room, on a piece of meat. No one heard him."
"Do you know, Mr. Arctor, that more deaths from that happen than people realize? I read that when you are dining with a friend, and he or she does not speak for a period of time but just sits there, you should lean forward and ask him if he can talk, because he may not be able to. He may be strangling and can't tell you."
"Yes," Arctor said. "Thanks, that's true. And thanks about the check."
"I'm sorry about your friend," the lady said.
"Yes," he said. "He was about the best friend I had."
"Oh, that is so dreadful," the lady said. "How old was he, Mr. Arctor?"
"In his early 30s, Arctor said, which was true. Luckman was 32.
"Oh, how terrible. I'll tell Carl, and thank you for coming all the way down here."
"Thank you," Arctor said. "And thank Mr. Engelson, too, for me. Thank you both so much." He departed, finding himself back out on the warm morning sidewalk, blinking in the bright light and foul air. He phoned for a cab, and on the journey back to his house, sat advising himself as to how well he had gotten out of this net of Barris's with no real overly bad scene. Could have been a lot worse, he pointed out to himself. The check was still there, and I didn't have to confront the dude himself. He got out the check to see how closely Barris had been able to approximate his handwriting. Yes, it was a dead account. He recognized the color of the check right away, an entirely closed one, and the bank had stamped it, "Account closed." No wonder the locksmith had gone bananas. And then, studying the check as he rode along, Arctor saw that the handwriting was his. Not anything like Barris's. A perfect forgery. He would never have known it wasn't his, except that he remembered not having written it.
"My God," he thought. "How many of these has Barris done by now? Maybe he's embezzled me out of half I've got."
Barris, he thought, is a genius. On the other hand, it's probably a tracing reproduction or anyhow mechanically done. But I never made a check out to Engelson Locksmith, so how could it be a transfer forgery? This is a unique check. I'll turn it over to the department graphologists, he decided, and let them figure out how it was done. Maybe just practice, practice, practice. As to the mushroom jazz, well, he thought, I'll just walk up to him and say, people told me he's been trying to sell the mushroom hits, and to knock it off. I got feedback from somebody worried, as they should be. But, he thought, these items are only random indications of what he's up to, discovered on the first replay. They only represent samples of what I'm up against. Christ knows what else he's done. He's got all the time in the world to loaf around and read reference books and dream up plots and intrigues and conspiracies and so forth. Maybe, he thought abruptly, I'd better have a trace run on my phone right away to see if it's tapped. Barris has a box of electronic hardware, and even Sony, for example, makes and sells an induction coil that can be used as a phone tapping device. The phone probably is. It probably has been for quite a while. I mean, he thought, in addition to my own recent necessary phone tap. Again, he studied the check as the cab jiggled along, and all at once he thought, what if I made it out myself? What if Arctur wrote this? I think I did, he thought. I think the motherfucking dingy Arctur himself wrote this check very fast, the letters slanted, because for some reason he was in a hurry. He dashed it off, got the wrong blank check, and afterward forgot all about it. Forgot the incident entirely. Forget, he thought, the time Arctur. Was grinsest du mir, holer Schadel hier? Als das dein Hirn, dein Neines, einst verwirret, den leichten Tag gesucht und in der Dämmerung schwer, mit Lust nach Wahrheit, jammerlich geret. Ooze out of that huge dope happening in Santa Ana, where he met that little blonde chick with odd teeth, long blonde hair, and a big ass, but so energetic and friendly. He couldn't get his car started. He was wired up to his nose. He kept having trouble. There was so much dope dropped and shot and snorted that night, it went on almost till dawn. So much substance D, and very primo. Very, very primo. His stuff. Leaning forward, he said, pull over at that Shell station. I'll get out there. He got out, paid the cab driver, then entered the payphone, looked up the locksmith's number, phoned him. The old lady answered.
Engelson Locksmith? Good.
This is Mr. Arctur. Again, I'm sorry to bother you. What address do you have for the call? The service call for which my check was made out?
Well, let me see. Just a moment, Mr. Arctur.
Bumping of the phone as she set it down. Distant, muffled man's voice.
Who is it? The doctor?
Yes, Carl, but don't say anything, please. He came in just now.
Let me talk to him.
Pause. Then the old lady again.
Well, I have this address, Mr. Arctur.
She read off his home address.
That's where your brother was called out to make the key.
Wait a moment.
Carl? Do you remember where you went in the truck to make the key for Mr. Arctur?
Distant man's rumble.
Aunt Catella.
Not his home?
Aunt Catella!
Somewhere on Catella, Mr. Arctur. In Anaheim. No, wait. Carl says it was in Santa Ana, on Maine. Does that...
Thanks, he said, and hung up. Santa Ana, Maine. That's where the fucking dope party was. And I must have turned in 30 names and as many license plates that night. That was not your standard party. A big shipment had arrived from Mexico. The buyers were splitting and, as usual with buyers, sampling as they split. Half of them now probably have been busted by buy agents sent out. Wow, he thought. I still remember, or never will correctly remember, that night. But that still doesn't excuse Barris from impersonating Arctur with malice aforethought on that phone call coming in. Except that, by the evidence, Barris had made it up on the spot. Improvised. Shit. Maybe Barris was wired the other night, and did what a lot of dudes do when they're wired. Just sort of groove with what's happening. Arctor wrote the check for a certainty. Barris just happened to pick up the phone. Thought in his charred head that it was a cool gag. Being irresponsible only, nothing more. And, he reflected as he dialed Yellow Cab again, Arctor has not been very responsible in making good on that check over this prolonged period. Whose fault is that? Getting it out once more, he examined the date on the check. A month and a half. Jesus, talk about irresponsibility. Arctor could wind up inside looking out for that. It's God's mercy that nutty Carl didn't go to the DA already. Probably his sweet old sister restrained him. Arctor, he decided, better get his ass in gear. He's done a few dingy things himself I didn't know about until now. Barris isn't the only one, or perhaps even the primary one. For one thing, there is still to be explained the cause of Barris's intense, concerted malice toward Arctor. A man doesn't set out over a long period of time to burn somebody for no reason. And Barris isn't trying to burn anybody else. Not, say, Luckman or Charles Freck or Donna Hawthorne. He helped get Jerry Fabin to the federal clinic more than anyone else, and he's kind to all the animals in the house. One time, Arctor had been going to send one of the dogs, what the hell was the little black one's name, Popo or something, to the pound to be destroyed. She couldn't be trained, and Barris had spent hours, in fact days, with Popo, gently training her and talking with her until she calmed down and could be trained, and so didn't have to go be snuffed. If Barris had general malice toward all, he wouldn't do numbers, good numbers like that. Yellow Cab, the phone said. He gave the address of the Shell station. And if Carl the locksmith had pegged Arctor as a heavy doper, he pondered as he lounged around moodily, waiting for the cab. It isn't Barris's fault. When Carl must have pulled up in his truck at 5 a.m. to make a key for Arctor's olds, Arctor probably was walking on jello sidewalks and up walls and batting off fisheyes and every other kind of good dope trip thing. Carl drew his conclusions then. As Carl ground the new key, Arctor probably floated around upside down or bounced about on his head, talking sideways. No wonder Carl had not been amused. In fact, he speculated, maybe Barris is trying to cover up for Arctor's increasing fuck-ups. Arctor is no longer keeping his vehicle in safe condition, as he once did. He's been hanging paper. Not deliberately, but because his goddamn brain is slushed from dope. But if anything, that's worse. Barris is doing what he can. That's a possibility. Only, his brain, too, is slushed. All their brains are... Denn würme gleich ich, der den Staub der Wult. Denn, weil sich in Staube nahend lebt... Des Wanders tritt vernichtet und begrabt. Slushed and mutually interacting in a slushed way. It's the slushed leading the slushed, and right into doom. Maybe, he conjectured, Arctor cut the wires and bent the wires and created all the shorts in his cephscope in the middle of the night. But for what reason? That would be a difficult one. Why? But with slushed brains, anything was possible. Any variety of twisted, like the wires themselves, motives. He'd seen it during his undercover law enforcement work many, many times. This tragedy was not new to him. This would be, in their computer files, just one more case. This was the phase ahead of the journey to the federal clinic, as with Jerry Fabin. All these guys walked one game board. Stood now in different squares, various distances from the goal, and would reach it at several times, but all eventually would reach it. The federal clinics. It was inscribed in their neural tissue, or what remained of it. Nothing could halt it or turn it back now. And, he had begun to believe, for Bob Arctor most of all. It was his intuition, just beginning, not dependent on anything Barris was doing. A new, professional insight. And also, his superiors at the Orange County Sheriff's Office had decided to focus on Bob Arctor. They no doubt had reasons which he knew nothing about. Perhaps these facts confirmed one another. Their growing interest in Arctor, after all, it had cost the department a bundle to install the holo scanners in Arctor's house, and to pay him to analyze the printouts, as well as others higher up to pass judgment on what he periodically turned over. This fitted in with Barris's unusual attention toward Arctur, both having selected Arctur as a primo target. But what had he seen himself in Arctur's conduct that struck him as unusual? Firsthand, not dependent on these two interests. As the taxi drove along, he reflected that he would have to watch a while to come across anything, more than likely. It would not disclose itself to the monitors in a day. He would have to be patient. He would have to resign himself to a long-term scrutiny and to put himself in a space where he was willing to wait. Once he saw something on the holoscanners, however, some enigmatic or suspicious behavior on Arctur's part, then a 3-point fix would exist on him, a third verification of the other's interests. Certainly, this would be a confirm. It would justify the expense and time of everyone's interest. I wonder what Barris knows that we don't know, he wondered. Maybe we should haul him in and ask him, but better to obtain material developed independently from Barris. Otherwise, it would be a duplication of what Barris, whoever he was or represented, had. And then he thought, what the hell am I talking about? I must be nuts. I know Bob Arctur. He's a good person. He's up to nothing. At least nothing unsavory. In fact, he thought, he works for the Orange County Sheriff's Office, covertly, which is probably... Sie seelen wohnen, ach, in meiner Brust. Der eine will sich von der anderen trennen. Der eine halt, in dürbe Lebenslust, sich an der Welt mit klammernden Organen. Der andere hebt gewaltsam sich vom Dust zu den Gefilden hoher Ahnen. Why, Barris is after him. But, he thought, that wouldn't explain why the Orange County Sheriff's Office is after him, especially to the extent of installing all those hollows and assigning a full-time agent to watch and report on him. Well, that wouldn't account for that. It does not compute. He thought. More, a lot more is going down in that house, that run-down, rubble-filled house with its weed-patch backyard and cat box that never gets emptied and animals walking on the kitchen table and garbage spilling over that no one ever takes out. What a waste, he thought, of a truly good house. So much could be done with it. A family, children, and a woman could live there. It was designed for that. 3 bedrooms. Such a waste, such a fucking waste. They ought to take it away from him, he thought. Enter the situation and foreclose. Maybe they will. And put it to better use. That house yearns for that. That house has seen so much better days long ago. Those days could return if another kind of person had it and kept it up. The yard especially, he thought, as the cab pulled into the newspaper-splattered driveway. He paid the driver, got out his door key, and entered the house. Immediately he felt something watching, the hollow scanners on him, as soon as he crossed his own threshold. Alone. No one but him in the house. Untrue. Him and the scanners, insidious and invisible, that watched him and recorded everything he did, everything he uttered. Like the scrolls on the wall when you're peeing in a public urinal, he thought. Smile, you're on candid camera. I am, he thought, as soon as I enter this house. It's eerie. He did not like it. He felt self-conscious. The sensation had grown since the first day when they'd arrived home. The dog shit days, he thought of it. Couldn't keep from thinking of it. Each day the experience of the scanners had grown. Nobody home, I guess. He stated aloud, as usual, and was aware that the scanners had picked that up. But he had to take care, always. He wasn't supposed to know they were there. Like an actor before a movie camera, he decided. You act like the camera doesn't exist, or else you blow it. It's all over. And for this shit, there are no take-twos. And what you get instead is wipeout. I mean, what I get. Not the people behind the scanners, but me. And what I ought to do, he thought, to get out of this is sell the house. It's run down anyway. But I love this house. No way. It's my house. Nobody can drive me out. For whatever reasons they would or do want to. Assuming there's a they at all. Which may just be my imagination, the they watching me. Paranoia. Or rather the it. The depersonalized it. Whatever it is that's watching, it is not a human. Not by my standards, anyhow. Not what I'd recognize. As silly as this is, he thought, it's frightening. Something is being done to me, and by a mere thing, here in my own house, before my very eyes. Within something's very eyes. Within the sight of some thing. Which, unlike little dark-eyed Donna, does not ever blink. What does the scanner see? He asked himself. I mean, really see? Into the head? Down into the heart? Does a passive infrared scanner like they used to use, or a cube-type holo scanner like they use these days, the latest thing, see into me, into us, clearly or darkly? I hope it does, he thought. See clearly, because I can't any longer these days see into myself. I see only murk. Murk outside, murk inside. I hope, for everyone's sake, the scanners do better. Because, he thought, if the scanner sees only darkly the way I myself do, then we are cursed. Cursed again, and like we have been continually, and will wind up dead this way, knowing very little, and getting that little fragment wrong too. From the living room bookcase, he took down a volume at random. It turned out to be, he discovered, the picture book of sexual love. Opening at random, he perceived a page, which showed a man nibbling happily at a chick's right tit and the chick sighing, and said aloud, as if reading to himself from the book, as if quoting from some famous old-time double-dome philosopher, which he was not, "Any given man sees only a tiny portion of the total truth, and very often, in fact, almost, they, stech ich in dem Kerker noch, wer Frucht ist dampfes Maloch, wo selbst das liebe Himmelschlicht, trub durchgemalte Scheiben bricht, beschrankt mit deißem Buchehauf, den Würmer nirgends Taube bedeckt, dem bis ans Hohe." Perpetually, he deliberately deceives himself about that little precious fragment as well. A portion of him turns against him and acts like another person, defeating him from inside. A man inside a man, which is no man at all. Nodding, as if moved by the wisdom of the non-existing written words on that page, he closed the large red-bound gold-stamped picture book of sexual love and restored it to the shelf. I hope the scanners don't zoom in on the cover of this book, he thought, and blow my shock. Charles Freck, becoming progressively more and more depressed by what was happening to everybody he knew, decided finally to off himself. There was no problem, in the circles where he hung out, in putting an end to yourself. You just bought into a large quantity of reds and took them with some cheap wine, late at night, with the phone off the hook so no one would interrupt you. The planning part had to do with the artifacts you wanted found on you by later archaeologists, so they'd know from which stratum you came, and also could piece together where your head had been at the time you did it. He spent several days deciding on the artifacts, much longer than he had spent deciding to kill himself, and approximately the same time required to get that many reds. He would be found lying on his back, on his bed, with a copy of Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead, which would prove he had been a misunderstood Superman rejected by the masses and so, in a sense, murdered by their scorn, and an unfinished letter to Exxon protesting the cancellation of his gas credit card. That way, he would indict the system and achieve something by his death, over and above what the death itself achieved. Actually, he was not as sure in his mind what the death achieved as what the two artifacts achieved, but anyhow, it all added up, and he began to make ready. Like an animal sensing its time has come and acting out its instinctive programming, laid down by nature, when its inevitable end was near. At the last moment, as end time closed in on him, he changed his mind on a decisive issue and decided to drink the Reds down with a connoisseur wine instead of Ripple or Thunderbird. So we set off on one last drive over to Trader Joe's, which specialized in fine wines, and bought a bottle of 1971 Mondavi Cabernet Sauvignon, which set him back almost $30, all he had. Back home again, he uncorked the wine, let it breathe, drank a few glasses of it, spent a few minutes contemplating his favorite page of the illustrated picture book of sex, which showed the girl on top, then placed the plastic bag of Reds beside his bed, lay down with the Ayn Rand book and unfinished protest letter to Exxon, tried to think of something meaningful but could not, although he kept remembering the girl being on top, and then, with a glass of the Cabernet Sauvignon, gulped down all the Reds at once. After that, the deed being done, he lay back, the Ayn Rand book and letter on his chest, and waited. However, he had been burned. The capsules were not barbiturates, as represented. They were some kind of kinky psychedelics, of a type he had never dropped before, probably a mixture, and new on the market. Instead of quietly suffocating, Charles Freck began to hallucinate.
Well, he thought philosophically, this is the story of my life. Always ripped off.
He had to face the fact, considering how many of the capsules he had swallowed, that he was in for some trip. The next thing he knew, a creature from between dimensions was standing beside his bed looking down at him disapprovingly. The creature had many eyes all over it, ultra-modern, expensive-looking clothing, and rose up 8 feet high. Also, it carried an enormous scroll.
You're gonna read me my sins, Charles Freck said.
The creature nodded and unsealed the scroll. Freck said, lying helpless on his bed,
and it's gonna take 100,000 hours.
Fixing its many compound eyes on him, the creature from between dimensions said,
we are no longer in the mundane universe. Lower plane categories of material existence, such as space and time, no longer apply to you. You have been elevated to the transcendent realm. Your sins will be read to you ceaselessly, in shifts, throughout eternity. The list will never end.
Know your dealer, Charles Freck thought, and wished he could take back the last half hour of his life.
1,000 years later, he was still lying there on his bed, with the Ayn Rand book and the letter to Exxon on his chest, listening to them read his sins to him. They'd gotten up to the first grade, when he was 6 years old. 10,000 years later, they had reached the 6th grade, the year he had discovered masturbation. He shut his eyes, but could still see the multi-eyed, 8-foot-high being with its endless scroll reading on and on.
And next, it was saying.
Charles Freck thought,
at least I got a good wine.
Chapter 12 2 days later, Fred, puzzled, watched Holoscanner 3 as his subject Robert Arctor pulled a book, evidently at random, from his bookshelf in the living room of his house. Dope stashed behind it, Fred wondered, and zoomed the scanner lens in. Or a phone number or address written in it. He could see that Arctor hadn't pulled the book to read. Arctor had just entered the house and still wore his coat. He had a peculiar air about him, tense and bummed out both at once, a sort of dulled urgency. The Zoomar lens of the scanner showed the page had a color photo of a man gnawing on a woman's right nipple, with both individuals nude. The woman was evidently having an orgasm. Her eyes had half shut, and her mouth hung open in a soundless moan. Maybe Arctor's using it to get off on, Fred thought as he watched. But Arctor paid no attention to the picture. Instead, he creakingly recited something mystifying, partly in German, obviously to puzzle anyone overhearing him. Maybe he imagined his roommates were somewhere in the house and wanted to bait them into appearing, Fred speculated. No one appeared. Luckman, Fred knew from having been at the scanners a long while, had dropped a bunch of Reds mixed with Substance D and passed out fully dressed in his bedroom, a couple of steps short of his bed. Barris had left entirely.
What is Arctor doing? Fred wondered,
and noted the ident code for these sections.
He's becoming more and more strange. I can see now what that informant who phoned in about him meant. Or, he conjectured, those sentences Arctor spoke aloud could be a voice command to some electronic hardware he'd installed in the house. Turn on or turn off. Maybe even create an interference field against scanning, such as this. But he doubted it. Doubted if it was in any way rational or purposeful or meaningful, except to Arctor. This guy is nuts, he thought. He really is. From the day he found his cephscope sabotaged, certainly the day he arrived home with his car all fucked up in such a way as to almost kill him, he's been dingy ever since. And to some extent before that, Fred thought. Anyhow, ever since the dogshit day, as he knew Arctor called it. Actually, he could not blame him. That, Fred reflected as he watched Arctor peel off his coat wearily, would blow anyone's mind. But most people would phase back in. He hasn't. He's getting worse. Reading aloud to no one, messages that don't exist and in foreign tongues. Unless he's shucking me, Fred thought with uneasiness. In some fashion figured out he's being monitored and is covering up what he's actually doing? Or just playing head games with us? Time, he decided, will tell. I see he's shucking us, Fred decided. Some people can tell when they're being watched. A sixth sense. Not paranoia, but a primitive instinct. What a mouse has, any hunted thing. Knows it's being stalked. Feels it. He's doing shit for our benefit, stringing us along. But you can't be sure. There are shucks on top of shucks. Layers and layers. The sound of Arctor reading obscurely had awakened Luckman, according to the scanner covering his bedroom. Luckman sat up groggily and listened. He then heard the noise of Arctor dropping a coat hanger while hanging up his coat. Luckman slid his long, muscular legs under him, and in one motion picked up a hand axe, which he kept on the table by his bed. He stood erect and moved, animal smoothly, toward the door of his bedroom. In the living room, Arctor picked up the mail from the coffee table and started through it. He tossed a large junk mail piece toward the wastebasket. It missed. In his bedroom, Luckman heard that. He stiffened and raised his head, as if to sniff the air. Arctor, reading the mail, suddenly scowled and said, "I'll be dipped." In his bedroom, Luckman relaxed, set the axe down with a clank, smoothed his hair, opened the door, and stepped out.
"Hi, what's happening?"
Arctor said,
"I drove by the Malar Microdot Corporation building."
"Oh, you're shitting me."
"And," Arctor said, "they were taking an inventory, but one of the employees evidently had tracked the inventory outdoors on the heel of his shoe, so they were all outside there, in the Malar Microdot Corporation parking lot with a pair of tweezers, and lots of little magnifying glasses, and a little paper bag."
Any reward?"
Luckman said, yawning and beating with his palms on his flat, hard gut.
"They had a reward they were offering," Arctor said. "But they lost that, too. It was a little tiny penny."
Luckman said,
"You see very many events of this nature as you're driving along?"
"Only in Orange County," Arctor said.
"How large is the Malar Microdot Corporation building?"
"About an inch high," Arctor said.
"How much would you estimate it weighs?"
"Including the employees?" Fred sent the tape spinning ahead at fast wind. When an hour had passed, according to the meter, he halted it momentarily.
"About 10 pounds, Arctor was saying. "Well, how can you tell, then, when you pass by it, if it's only an inch high and only weighs 10 pounds?
Arctor, now sitting on the couch with his feet up, said,
They have a big sign."
"Jesus," Fred thought, and again sent the tape ahead. He halted it at only 10 minutes elapsed real time, on a hunch.
"What's the sign look like?" Luckman was saying.
He sat on the floor, cleaning a box full of grass.
"A neon and like that? Colors? I wonder if I've seen it. Is it, conspicuous?"
"Here, I'll show it to you," Arctor said, reaching into his shirt pocket.
I brought it home with me. Again, Fred sent the tape at fast forward.
You know how you could smuggle microdots into a country without them knowing?
Luckman was saying. It would, you know, just about any way you wanted, Archer said, leaning back, smoking a joint. The air was cloudy.
No, I mean a way they'd never flash on, Luckman said. It was Barris who suggested this to me one day, confidentially. And I wasn't supposed to tell anyone because he's putting it in his book.
What book? Common Household Dope and...
No. Simple ways to smuggle objects into the U.S. and out, depending on which way you're going. You smuggle it in with a shipment of dope, like with heroin. The microdots are down inside the packets. Nobody'd notice. They're so small. They won't... But then some junkie'd shoot up ahead of half smack and half microdots.
Well, then he'd be the fuckingest educated junkie you ever did see.
Well, depending on what was on the microdots.
Bass had his other way to smuggle dope across the border. You know how the customs guys, they ask you to declare what you have? And you can't say dope, because...
Okay, how?
Well, see, you take a huge block of hash and carve it in the shape of a man. Then you hollow out a section and put a wind-up motor like a clockwork's in it, and a little cassette tape, and you stand in line with it. And then just before it goes through customs, you wind up the key, and it walks up to the customs man, who says to it, "Do you have anything to declare?" And the block of hash says, "No, I don't," and keeps on walking, until it runs down on the other side of the border.
You could put a solar-type battery in it instead of a spring, and it could keep walking for years, forever.
Well, what's the use of that? It'd finally reach either the Pacific or the Atlantic. In fact, it'd walk off the edge of the Earth, like...
Imagine an Eskimo village and a 6-foot-high block of hash worth about... How much would that be worth?
About $1 billion?
Oh, more. $2 billion.
These Eskimos are chewing hides and carving bone spears, and this block of hash worth $2 billion comes walking through the snow, saying over and over, "No, I don't."
They'd wonder what it meant by that.
Oh, they'd be puzzled forever. They'd be legends.
Can you imagine telling your grandkids, "I saw with my own eyes this 6-foot-high block of hash appear out of the blinding fog and walk past, that way, worth $2 billion, saying, "No, I don't." His grandchildren would have him committed.
Now, see, legends build. After a few centuries, they'd be saying, "In my forefather's time, one day, a 90-foot-high block of extremely good quality Afghanistan hash worth $8 trillion came at us, dripping fire and screaming, 'Die, Eskimo dogs!' And we fought and fought with it, using our spears, and finally killed it."
The kids wouldn't believe that either.
Yeah, kids never believe anything anymore.
It's a downer to tell anything to a kid. I once had a kid ask me, "What was it like to see the first automobile?" Shit, man, I was born in 1962.
Christ, Archer said.
I once had a guy I knew burned out on acid ask me that. He was 27 years old. I was only 3 years older than him. He didn't know anything anymore. Later on, he dropped some more hits of acid, or what he was sold as acid. And after that, he peed on the floor and crapped on the floor. And when you said something to him like, "How are you, Don?" he just repeated it after you like a bird. "How are you, Don?" Silence then, between the two joint-smoking men in the cloudy living room. A long, somber silence.
"Bob, you know something," Luckman said at last. "I used to be the same age as everyone else."
"I think so was I," Archer said.
"I don't know what did it."
"Sure, Luckman," Archer said. "You know what did it to all of us."
"Well, let's not talk about it,"
he continued, inhaling noisily, his long face sallow in the dim midday light. One of the phones in the safe apartment rang. A scramble suit answered it, then extended it toward Fred. "Fred?" He shut off the hollows and took the phone. Remember when you were downtown last week? A voice said, being administered the BG test.
After an interval of silence, Fred said, Yes.
You were supposed to come back.
A pause at that end, too.
We've processed more recent material on you. I have taken it upon myself to schedule you for the full standard battery of percept tests, plus other testing. Your time for this is tomorrow, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the same room. It will take about 4 hours in all. Do you remember the room number?
No, Fred said.
How are you feeling?
Okay, Fred said stoically.
Any problems in your work or outside your work?
I had a fight with my girl.
Any confusion? Are you experiencing any difficulty identifying persons or objects? Does anything you see appear inverted or reversed? And while I'm asking, any space-time or language disorientation?
No, he said glumly. No to all the above.
I will see you tomorrow at room 203, the psychologist deputy said.
What material of mine did you find to be...
We'll take that up tomorrow. Be there, all right? And, Fred, don't get discouraged.
Click. I'll click to you, too, he thought, and hung up. With irritation, sensing that they were leaning on him, making him do something he resented doing, he snapped the hollows into printout once more. The cubes lit up with color, and the three-dimensional scenes within animated. From the odd tap, more purposeless, frustrating, to Fred, babble emerged.
And this chick, Luckman droned on, had gotten knocked up, and she applied for an abortion because she'd missed, like, 4 periods, and she was conspicuously swelling up. And she did nothing but gripe about the cost of the abortion. She couldn't get on public assistance for some reason. Now, one day, I was over at her place, and this girlfriend of hers was there, telling her she only had a hysterical pregnancy. You just want to believe you're pregnant. And this chick was nattering at her. It's a guilt trip. And the abortion and the heavy bread it's going to cost you, that's a penance trip. So the chick, I really dug her. She looked up calmly and she said, Okay, then if it's a hysterical pregnancy, I'll get a hysterical abortion and pay for it with hysterical money.
Arthur said, I wonder whose face is on the hysterical $5 bill.
Well, who was our most hysterical president?
Bill Faulks. He only thought he was president.
When did he think he served?
He imagined he served 2 terms back around 1882. Later on, after a lot of therapy, he came to imagine he served only 1 term. With great fury, Fred slammed the hollows ahead 2.5 hours.
How long does this garbage go on? He asked himself. All day? Forever? So you take your child to the doctor, to the psychologist, and you tell him how your child screams all the time and has tantrums.
Luckman had 2 lids of grass before him on the coffee table, plus a can of beer. He was inspecting the grass.
And lies. The kid lies. Makes up exaggerated stories. And the psychologist examines the kid, and his diagnosis is, Madam, your child is hysterical. You have a hysterical child, but I don't know why. And then you, the mother, there's your chance, and you lay it on him. I know why, doctor. It's because I had a hysterical pregnancy.
Both Luckman and Arctor laughed, and so did Jim Barris. He had returned sometime during the 2 hours and was with them, working on his funky hash pipe, winding white string. Again, Fred spun the tape forward a full hour.
This guy, Luckman was saying, manicuring a box full of grass, hunched over it as Arctor sat across from him, more or less watching. Appeared on TV, claiming to be a world-famous imposter. He had posed at one time or another, he told the interviewer, as a great surgeon at Johns Hopkins Medical College. A theoretical submolecular high-velocity particle research physicist on a federal grant at Harvard. As a Finnish novelist who'd won the Nobel Prize in Literature, as a deposed president of Argentina, married to...
And he got away with all that? Arctor asked. He never got caught.
The guy never posed as any of those. He never posed as anything
but a world-famous imposter. See, that came out later in the L.A. Times. They checked up. The guy pushed a broom at Disneyland, or had until he read this autobiography about this world-famous imposter, but it really was one, and he said, well, hell, I can pose as all those exotic dudes and get away with it like he did. And then he decided, well, hell, why do that? I just pose as another imposter. He made a lot of bread that way, the Times said. Almost as much as a real world-famous imposter. And he said it was a lot easier.
Barris, off to himself in a corner winding strings, said, we see imposters now and then in our lives, but not posing as subatomic physicists.
Knox, you mean, Luckman said. Yeah, Knox. I wonder how many Knox we know.
What's a narc look like?
That's like asking, what's an imposter look like? Arctor said. I talked one time to a big hash dealer who'd been busted with 10 pounds of hash in his possession. I asked him what the narc who busted him looked like. You know, the, what do you call them? Buying agent that came out and posed as a friend of a friend and got him to sell him some hash.
Looked, Barris said, winding string. Just like us.
More so, Arctor said. The hash dealer dude, he'd already been sentenced and was going in the following day. He told me, they have longer hair than we do. So, no, I guess the moral of that is, stay away from guys looking the same as us.
There are female narcs, Barris said.
I'd like to meet a narc, Arctor said. I mean, knowingly, where I could be positive.
Well, Barris said, you could be positive when it claps the cuffs on you, when that day comes.
Arctor said, I mean, do narcs have friends? What sort of social life do they have? Do their wives know?
Narcs don't have wives, Luckman said. They live in caves and peep out from under parked cars as you pass, like trolls.
What do they eat? Arctor said.
People, Barris said.
How could a guy do that? Arctor said. Pose as a narc.
What?
Both Barris and Luckman said together.
Shit, I'm spaced, Arctor said, grinning. Pose as a narc.
Wow. He shook his head, grimacing now.
Staring at him, Luckman said, pose as a narc? Pose as a narc?
My brains are scrambled today, Arctor said. I better go crash. At the Hollows, Fred cut the tape's forward motion. All the cubes froze, and the sound ceased.
Taking a break, Fred?
One of the other scramble suits called over to him.
Yeah, Fred said. I'm tired. How this crap gets to you after a while.
He rose and got out his cigarettes.
I can't figure out half what they're saying. I'm so tired.
Tired, he added, of listening to them.
When you're actually down there with them,
the scramble suit said,
it's not so bad, you know? Like I guess you were on the scene itself up until now, with a cover, right?
I would never hang around with creeps like that, Fred said, saying the same things over and over, like old cons. Why do they do what they do, sitting there shooting the bull?
Why do we do what we do? This is pretty damn monotonous when you get down to it.
But we have to. This is our job. We have no choice.
Like the cons, the scramble suit pointed out. We have no choice.
Posing as a narc, Fred thought. What does that mean? Nobody knows.
Posing, he reflected, as an imposter. One who lives under parked cars and eats dirt. Not a world-famous surgeon or novelist or politician. Nothing that anyone would care to hear about on TV. No life that anyone in their right mind. I resemble that worm which crawls through dust, lives in the dust, eats dust, until a passerby's foot crushes it. As that expresses it, he thought. That poetry.
Luckman must have read it to me, or maybe I read it in school. Funny what the mind pops up, remembers. Arctor's freaky words still stuck in his mind, even though he had shut off the tape.
I wish I could forget it,
he thought. I wish I could for a while forget him. I get the feeling, Fred said, that sometimes I know what they're going to say before they say it. Their exact words.
Yeah, it's called deja vu,
one of the scramble suits agreed.
Let me give you a few pointers. Run the tape ahead, over longer break intervals. Not an hour, but say 6 hours. Then run it back, if there's nothing until you hit something. Back, you see, rather than forward. That way you don't get into the rhythm of their flow. 6 or even 8 ahead, then big jumps back. You'll get the hang of it pretty soon. You'll get so you can sense when you've got miles and miles of nothing, or when somewhere you've got something useful. And you won't really listen at all, the other scramble suit said, until you do actually hit something. Like a mother when she's asleep. Nothing wakes her, even a truck going by until she hears her baby cry. That wakes her. That alerts her, no matter how faint that cry is. The unconscious is selective when it learns what to listen for.
I know, Fred said. I've got 2 kids.
Boys?
Girls, he said. 2 little girls.
Oh, that's all right, one of the scramble suits said. I have 1 girl, 1 year old.
No names, please, the other scramble suit said. And they all laughed. A little. Anyhow, there is an item, Fred said to himself, to extract from the total tape and pass along. That cryptic statement about posing as a narc. The other men in the house with Arctur, it surprised them, too. When I go in tomorrow at 3, he thought, I'll take a print of that. Aud alone would do, and discuss it with Hank, along with what else I obtain between now and then. But even if that's all I've got to show, Hank, he thought, it's a beginning. Shows, he thought, that this around-the-clock scanning of Arctur is not a waste. It shows, he thought, that I was right. That remark was a slip. Arctur blew it. But what it meant, he did not yet know. But we will, he said to himself, find out. We will keep on Bob Arctur until he drops. Unpleasant as it is to have to watch and listen to him and his pals all the time. Those pals of his, he thought, are as bad as he is. How'd I ever sit around in that house with them all that time? What a way to live a life. What, as the other officer said just now, an endless nothing. Down there, he thought, in the murk of the mind, and the murk outside as well. Murk everywhere, thanks to what they are, that kind of individual. Carrying his cigarette, he walked back to the bathroom, shut and locked the door. Then from inside the cigarette package, he got out 10 tabs of death. Filling a Dixie cup with water, he dropped all 10 tabs. He wished he had brought more tabs with him.
Well, he thought, I can drop a few more when I get through work, when I get back home.
Looking at his watch, he tried to compute how long that would be. His mind felt fuzzy. How the hell long will it be? He asked himself, wondering what had become of his time sense.
Watching the hollows has fucked it up, he realized. I can't tell what time it is at all anymore. I feel like I've dropped acid and then gone through a car wash, he thought. Lots of titanic, whirling, soapy brushes coming at me, dragged along by a chain into tunnels of black foam. What a way to make a living, he thought, and unlocked the bathroom door to go back, reluctantly, to work.
When he turned on the tape transport once more, Arctur was saying,
Well, as near as I can figure out, God is dead.
Luckman answered,
I didn't know he was sick. Now that my old is laid up indefinitely, Arctur said, I've decided I should sell it, buy a Henway.
What's a Henway?
Barris said. To himself, Fred said, About 3 pounds.
About 3 pounds, Arctur said.
The following afternoon at 3 o'clock, 2 medical officers, not the same 2, administered several tests to Fred, who was feeling even worse than he had the day before. In rapid succession, you will see a number of objects with which you should be familiar pass in sequence before, first, your left eye, and then your right. At the same time, on the illuminated panel directly before you,
outline reproductions will appear simultaneously of several such familiar objects, and you are to match, by means of the punch pencil, what you consider to be the correct outline reproduction of the actual object visible at that instant. Now, these objects will move by you very rapidly, so do not hesitate too long. You will be time-scored as well as scored for accuracy. Okay?
Okay, Fred said. Punch pencil ready.
A whole flock of familiar objects jogged past him then, and he punched away at the illuminated photos below. This took place for his left eye, and then it all happened again for his right. Next, with your left eye covered, a picture of a familiar object will be flashed to your right eye. You are to reach with your left hand, repeat, left hand, into a group of objects and find the one whose picture you saw.
Okay, Fred said.
A picture of a single die was flashed. With his left hand, he groped around among small objects placed before him until he found a die. In the next test, several letters which spell out a word will be available to your left hand, unseen. You will feel them, and then, with your right hand, write out the word the letters spell. He did that. They spelled hot. Now, name the word spelled. So, he said, hot. Next, you will reach into this absolutely dark box, and with both eyes covered, and with your left hand, touch an object in order to identify it. Then tell us what the object is, without having seen it visually. After that, you will be shown three objects somewhat resembling one another, and you will tell us which of the three that you see most resembles the object you manually touched.
Okay, Fred said, and he did that then, and other tests, for almost an hour. Grope, tell, look at with one eye, select. Grope, tell, look at with the other eye, select. Write down, draw.
In this following test, you will, with your eyes again covered, reach out and feel an object with each hand. You are to tell us if the object presented to your left hand is identical to the object presented to your right. He did that. Here in rapid succession are pictures of triangles in various positions. You are to tell us if it is the same triangle or... After 2 hours, they had him fit complicated blocks into complicated holes and timed him doing this. He felt as if he was in first grade again and screwing up. Doing worse than he had then.
Miss Frankel, he thought. Old Miss Frankel. She used to stand there and watch me do this shit back then, flashing me die messages, like they say in transactional analysis. Die. Do not be. Witch messages. A whole bunch of them. Until I did finally fuck up.
Probably Miss Frankel was dead by now. Probably somebody had managed to flash her a die message back, and it had caught. He hoped so. Maybe it had been one of his. As with the psych testers now, he flashed such messages right back. It didn't seem to be doing much good now. The test continued. What is wrong with this picture? One object among the others does not belong. You are to mark...
He did that.
And then it was actual objects, one of which did not belong. He was supposed to reach out and manually remove the offending object, and then, when the test was over, pick up all the offending objects from a variety of sets, as they were called, and say what characteristic, if any, all the offending objects had in common, if they constituted a set. He was still trying to do that when they called time and ended the battery of testing and told him to go have a cup of coffee and wait outside until called. After an interval, which seemed damn long to him, a tester appeared and said, "One more thing, Fred. We want a sample of your blood." He gave him a slip of paper, a lab requisition. "Go down the hall to the room marked Pathology Lab and give them this, and then after they have taken a blood sample, come back here again and wait."
"Sure," he said glumly, and shuffled off with the requisition. "Traces in the blood," he realized. "They're testing for that."
When he had gotten back to room 203 from the pathology lab, he rounded up one of the testers and said,
"Would it be all right if I went upstairs to confer with your superior while I'm waiting for your results? I'll be taking off for the day soon."
"Affirmative," the psych tester said. "Since we decided to have a blood sample taken, it will be longer before we can make our evaluation." "Yes, go ahead. We'll phone upstairs when we're ready for you back here. Hank, is it?"
Yes, Fred said. "I'll be upstairs with Hank."
The psych tester said, "You certainly seem much more depressed today than you did when we first saw you."
"Pardon?" Fred said.
"The first time you were in, last week, you were kidding and laughing, although very tense."
Gazing at him, Fred realized that this was one of the two medical deputies he had originally encountered. But he said nothing. He merely grunted and then left their office, made his way to the elevator.
"What a downer," he thought. "This whole thing. I wonder which of the two medical deputies it is," he wondered. "The one with the handlebar mustache or the other?" "Why, I guess the other. This one has no mustache." "You will manually feel this object with your left hand," he said to himself. "And at the same time, you will look at it with your right. And then, in your own words, you will tell us..." He could not think out any more nonsense. Not without their help.
When he entered Hank's office, he found another man, not in a scramble suit, seated in the far corner, facing Hank. Hank said, "This is the informant who phoned in about Bob Arctor using the grid. I mentioned him."
"Yes," Fred said, standing there unmoving.
"This man again phoned in with more information about Bob Arctor. We told him he'd have to step forth and identify himself. We challenged him to appear down here, and he did. Do you know him?"
"Sure I do," Fred said, staring at Jim Barris, who sat grinning and fiddling with a pair of scissors. Barris appeared ill at ease and ugly. Super ugly, Fred thought, with revulsion. "You're James Barris, aren't you?" he said. "Have you ever been arrested?"
"His ID shows him to be James R. Barris," Hank said, "and that is who he claims to be." He added, "He has no arrest record."
"What does he want?" To Barris, Fred said, "What's your information?"
"I have evidence," Barris said in a low voice, "that Mr. Arctor is part of a large secret covert organization, well-funded, with arsenals of weapons at their disposal, using code words, probably dedicated to the overthrow of..."
"That part is speculation," Hank interrupted. "What you suppose it's up to? What's your evidence? Now don't give us anything that is not first-hand."
"Have you ever been sent to a mental hospital?" Fred said to Barris.
"No,"
Barris said. "Will you sign a sworn, notarized statement at the DA's office," Fred continued, "regarding your evidence and information? Will you be willing to appear in court under oath and..."
"He has already indicated he would," Hank interrupted.
"My evidence," Barris said, "which I mostly don't have with me today, but which I can produce, consists of tape recordings I have made of Robert Arctor's phone conversations. I mean, conversations when he didn't know I was listening."
"What is this organization?" Fred said.
"I believe it to be," Barris began, but Hank waved him off. "It is political," Barris said, perspiring and trembling a little, but looking pleased. "And against the country, from outside, an enemy against the U.S.
Fred said, "What is Arctor's relationship with the source of Substance D?" Blinking and licking his lip and grimacing, Barris said,
"It is in my..." He broke off. "When you examine all my information, you will... that is, my evidence, you will undoubtedly conclude that Substance D is produced by a foreign nation determined to overthrow the U.S., and that Mr. Arctor has his hands deep within the machinery of this..."
"Can you tell us specific names of anyone else in this organization?" Hank said. "Persons Arctor has met with. You understand that giving false information to the legal authorities is a crime, and if you do so, you can and probably will be cited."
"I understand that," Barris said.
Who has Arctor conferred with?
Hank said. A Miss Donna Hawthorne, Barris said. On various pretexts, he goes over to her place and colludes with her regularly. Fred laughed. Colludes? What do you mean? I have followed him, Barris said, speaking slowly and distinctly, in my own car, without his knowledge.
He goes there often? Hank said.
Yes, sir, Barris said. Very often as... She's his girl, Fred said. Barris said, Mr. Arctor also... Turning to Fred, Hank said,
You think there's any substance in this?
We should definitely look at his evidence, Fred said.
Bring in your evidence, Hank instructed Barris. All of it. The names we want most of all. Names, license plate numbers, phone numbers. Have you ever seen Arctor deeply involved in large amounts of drugs, more than a user's?
Certainly, Barris said.
What types?
Several kinds. I have samples. I carefully took samples for you to analyze. I can bring them in, too, quite a bit, and varied. Hank and Fred glanced at each other.
Barris, sightlessly gazing straight ahead, smiled. Is there anything else you want to say at this time?
Hank said to Barris.
To Fred, he said. And maybe we should send an officer with him to get his evidence?
Meaning, to make sure he doesn't panic and split, doesn't try to change his mind and pull out.
There is one thing I would like to say, Barris said. Mr. Arctor is an addict, addicted to Substance D, and his mind is deranged now. It has slowly become deranged over a period of time, and he is dangerous.
Dangerous, Fred echoed.
Yes, Barris declared. He is already having episodes, such as occur with brain damage from Substance D. The optic chiasm must be deteriorated, since a weak ipsilateral component... But also...
Barris cleared his throat.
A deterioration as well in the corpus callosum. This kind of unsupported speculation, Hank said, as I already informed you, warned you, is worthless. Anyhow, we will send an officer with you to get your evidence. All right?
Grinning, Barris nodded.
But, naturally, we'll arrange for an officer out of uniform.
I might, Barris gestured,
be murdered. Mr. Arctor, as I say,
Hank nodded.
All right, Mr. Barris, we appreciate this and your extreme risk. And if it works out, if your information is of significant value in obtaining a conviction in court, then naturally...
I'm not here for that reason, Barris said. The man is sick, brain damaged, from Substance D. The reason I am here...
We don't care why you're here, Hank said. We only care whether your evidence and material amount to anything. The rest is your problem.
Thank you, sir, Barris said, then grinned.